Okay, good. And I've got the mic back on. So what's happening is the TA got grading done for project one, but like all good TAs, he got it done at 2 in the morning. So what he did is he sent me a PDF. He did a really nice job. He's got one page for each of you with all the tests he ran and how well you did on this and how well you did on that, extra credit, et cetera, maybe some comments if a couple of cases, but only a couple. He wasn't able to get it to compile, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But in most cases, folks did really well, but you like to know what you're doing. We have a link to where his test cases are. So if you have a disagreement and, you know, he says it didn't work and you say it did work, you know, then you have a basis for testing that. So right now, one of the students is printing out those sheets at the printer, wherever it is, and presumably that'll be done. So while that's happening, let me just talk about some other material. Apparently, there's some kind of users meeting coming up. I was in here yesterday now, so some tables going up, and I saw an interesting sign of what's happening is there was a huge pallet about this big square of boxes and boxes and boxes of potato chips. So I said, either the workers all of a sudden got a craze for potato chips, or we have a lot of visitors coming who are going to eat some free potato chips. So whatever, that's a sign that's coming. And as a result, we're going to be changed to some extent in our meeting places, and I've got notice up here. I'll also send that to Piazza. But for office hour starting not this week, so Thursday's office hour will be as usual over in Dune, but for, looks like, most of March, it'll be somewhere in an Andromeda called the Bar. Now, do you folks know where that is? You probably, yeah, that's not a real bar by any chance, is it? No, this is a teetotaler campus, right? You're not allowed to do any brewskis or stronger. So wherever the bar is, I need to figure that out. Now, I did figure out that if I walk past Mirror Commons to the observation area and go down a level, there's a tunnel to Andromeda. Would it be the case that the bar and this other place, Delphi, are near there? No? Okay. Well, my other choice is I can park over in the area by the solar panels, and there's a main entrance sign. I go into that, and I think that gets me into Andromeda, and that would be better? Okay, good. So I'll do that. So anyway, office hours will be in the bar. Lectures for two lectures will be in Delphi, and that is in Andromeda? Okay, so you know better than I. And I'm warned that does not have desktop computers on it. So bring your own laptop if you want to follow along or, you know, do something else or, you know, whatever it is while I'm lecturing. Okay, are our grade sheets coming out? Can you print them all? I mean, it's just one big file.
I know.
Oh, to test. Sure, that makes sense. Okay. So we'll see how fast the printers are. Turns out in our department, we put in a brand new fancy a copier. You know, top of the line, they said, and all that. But what this foolish thing does is, because it has to be green and save energy, it turns itself off in the middle of the day. If you don't send it any business for about 5 or 10 minutes, it says, I'm wasting energy, and turns itself off. And then you go up there and you have to warm it up again, and it takes about 5 minutes to warm up. So whatever, I hope it's not one of those printers. It's actually the case, the office printers print out faster than this thing does in terms of if you factor in the lag time to get the thing warmed up. So I guess that's the new reality, is that, you know, if you don't turn the machines off, they'll turn themselves off for you. But anyway, let me talk a little about the grading. Most people did quite well, and you'll be able to see. Let me start my timer so that we get that taken care of, too. So I'm going to return the grade sheets as soon as they get printed. The basis of the grade was 100 for just the basic problem, and that he think he did 11 tests, so it was 9 and a fraction points per test, and a maximum of 20 for extra credit for those who claimed it. Hence, the maximum grade you could get was 120, and some people did do that. In fact, many people did pretty close to that. The lowest grade was 0, and there were a couple of people got 0. Now, if you're one of those, don't panic, because what happened was, in some cases, he just couldn't compile. In at least one case, it's not, almost certainly not your fault. It's just incompatibility issues. In other cases, he'd like to give partial credit, but what you need to do is contact him and tell, you know, your estimation of how much was working. Was it a case that there was, you're really one bug away, or was it, it's a total muddle and it's going to take a lot of time to get it up to snuff so that he can get some estimate of how accurately you do it. Just looking at code that doesn't compile is kind of hard because it may be easily fixable or it may not be. So the program tests, if you want to follow, are at that. It's usual www.cs.wis.edu. Meng Hue, or whatever you pronounce it, is his login name, so that's easy to remember. 536/P1 is the Project 1 test, and it's in zip form because there's a number of tests he ran. So if you care to look those up, you're welcome to do so. A couple of people ran their programs in Java 8. Oh, thank you. That was fast. Okay, well, good. So warm off the printer, so you know they're good. I mean, they're nice and warm, just like toaster out of the oven or toaster out of the toast. Yeah, that's fine. So please avoid Java 8, even if you're proficient with it. Back at the university, we're only at level 7, and they sort of have rules that they don't want some machines running 8 and some 7 because of incompatibility issues. So I think he said in his message that he manually went in and changed them back to level 7 compatibility, but don't expect him to do that in future. So if you're in Eclipse or something, set your level back from 8 to 7. If you can do it, yes, that'll probably save him some time and you won't be penalized for it. But it's just one of those things where I didn't realize, I should have put it together because early in the semester we were having lots of trouble at the university with bringing up Eclipse with Java 8. Apparently, some of the JDK type stuff or runtime stuff was not installed properly or something. And anyway, the kids were trying and it wasn't running. So they said, what the heck? 8 isn't that much of an improvement over 7. We'll go back to 7, get our act together, and upgrade to 8 probably for the next academic semester. So one particular person, you're not in trouble, but you did it differently, is that you use JUnit, I guess unit testing for Java, and that's not on CS machines. So contact the TA and we'll come to some way of him getting a version that's doable. Perhaps even the simplest way is for you to run it on your machine, take the tests that are in that zip file and run the tests and send them to him as output. We're kind of sort of on the honor system here. I'm kind of amazed at this. Back at the university, one of the first rules you learn is don't leave your laptop unattended. And you, of course, know why that is, because the university is a pretty open environment and most of the kids are great people, but there are great people around, there's people who are not so great who want to take advantage of them. And leaving a laptop around is like leaving a couple of $100 on the table saying, please steal me. Here, apparently, that's not the case. I've left stuff around and nothing's disappeared yet. When it does, Judy's going to get a bill, but I'm sure she can afford it. But no, I mean, it's nice to have the honor system, and I'm going to try to honor that as much as possible. So in this case, probably the easiest is for that individual, run it on your machine, you know, just put the output and say, you know, it runs fine, and here's the outputs, and please grade on that basis, and we'll take you on that. And for a couple of cases, as I said, if there's a note on the form says it just couldn't compile, contact the TA, explain honestly, was it close, not so close, this was working, that was not working, so he has a better basis of deciding how much credit to give. Oh yeah, for the grade range, 0 to 120, and the median was 110. The median is the halfway point. We have roughly 80 people. So that means there are roughly 35 to 40 people above perfect, which is good because it means, to me, most everybody got the basic problem working or pretty near working. And for those who even had some problems, you got enough extra credit to go over the limit. He said the most common problems, and I don't have that on this sheet, but he said to me, was one that you didn't follow the suggested format closely enough. The only thing there is we're trying to automate the testing as much as possible, as you might imagine. So we have expected output, your output, and we do a diff between them, a program that says how different are they, and hopefully it says they're not different, which means what you did and what we expected was the same, and that's fine. In some cases, it didn't diff very well, so we had to manually inspect that. That was not a big issue. The other major issue, oops, I keep talking and my machine goes dead, was that you got block structure symbol tables implemented improperly. In some cases, it worked for some, but not others. He had a couple of programs in there that tested the heck out of scoping. You know, open a scope, define something, close a scope, open a new scope, redefine it, and in and out, in and out. And if you did your block structure symbol table right, should have been no problemo. If you didn't do it right, sometimes, you know, you got scoping wrong, and that would catch that one. So that was the most common other problem. Oops. So let me just hand these back, and this will give me a chance to associate faces with names, too. I think these are in alphabetical order, so it doesn't prove anything on grades. Brian Baker. He's the one who's supposed to deliver the material. Another Brian Baker, so he's still not here. Begwala Junaid, J-U-N-A-I-D. Jonathan Block. This way you also see who's attending and who's not. Matt Bromsky. Eric Boyd. Theodore Brenner. If you're a B, you can kind of know what's coming. And if you're a Z, you can just take a nap for a bit. Blake Campbell. Carl Carlson. Josh Shansard. These ones are easy. Last semester I had an Indian fellow whose last name was 17 letters. And nobody ever pronounced it right, even at home, I would imagine. Ryan Kalippi. Clark Downham. Lorian Dreger. Sam Felt. Timothy Fairisen. Not here today, or not? Okay. Benjamin Fleming. Room looks almost filled. Huh? Got some shills in here or something? Brandon Frank. Actually, I went to school at Cornell, and while I was there, the School of Astrophysics had a fellow named Carl Sagan on the faculty. And son of a gun, you know, he was doing intro to astronomy sort of thing, and he had a class of maybe 30 or 40 people, and the room was always filled with people hanging on the rails and sitting in the aisles and all that. And they never threw us out. It was good. I mean, everybody said, oh, gee, a chance to actually see Carl Sagan. And that was really amazing. Usually people that famous don't teach low-level courses, but he did, and it was a great opportunity. Dan Gerber. Yesheng Ji, G-E. Eric Gross. Osama Hamid. Jacob Harper. Michael Hudson. Eugene Huen, Isaac Stewart, okay, Johnson Grant, I think that's probably the last name, Gentoff or Johnson Grant, which is the last name? Okay. Dustin Carrolls with a K. And it's hard to spell Dustin with a K. Allison Cator. Cator or Cator? Cator. Thanks. Yeah. Susanna Kelly. Yeah, that felt too thick. Michael Kellum. Eric Kleinberg. Stephen Lampier. Corwin Lawrence, or Lawrence Corwin, it's always. Anne Litersky. John Liu. Tim Lohr. James Makrzewski. Is it Makrzewski or Makrzewski? Okay. Didn't do too bad. Dustin Maiden. Yeah, sure. Mason Madsen, no, Madden, sorry. Luke Matthews. Lynn McCormick. Oh, it went off, okay. And you're Lynn, right? So I just hit one. Patrick McDonald. Are you bringing in the brew on March 17th? Yeah. Andrew Maranovich. Yeah. Nicholas Mollick. Kirsten Moore. Whistla Blaze Norton. Is Norton the last name? Okay. So it should.
The hyphen should be.
I'm not probably not the first time. Excuse me.
I got those.
Oh, cool. I'm gonna print it in the second time. Thanks. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, thanks. We got a spare copy if you want to send one home to mom. Matthew Owen. Robert Owen? Oh, there's two Owens. Trey Pick. Eliezer Posner. I think these things are sticky. Catherine Pracknow. Carson Quinlan. Malcolm Reed. Patrick Robichaud, something like that. Cool. No X, right? Yeah. Michael Stanza, Yeah, Santana, duh, yeah. Trying to, the guy compliments me and I screw one up. That's the way it goes. Nicholas Schober. Got that one right. Emma Schultz. Denzel Showers. Ravi Srivastana. Srivastana, that's not too bad. Punat Singh. Ryan Smith. Are people going to sleep on me, or I'll wake them up? Derek Thompson. Raghuram Vempati. Joel Thompson. Christopher Viering. No, I'm sorry, Viernig. David Whelan. Michael White. No relation to Walter White, yeah? No? Everybody know who Walter White is? On the great television characters of all time. Wesley Shmazotula. How badly did I do?
It's Shamatula.
Okay, not too bad. Daniel Wilmer. Queen Yin, Y-I-N. Daniel Yogurst. And who must be the last man? Starts with a Z. It must be you, right? Yeah. It's like the old joke of, what do they call the person who ranks last in med school? Doctor. Always makes you feel good when you see a young physician. Okay, for those who came in a little bit late, what I've been doing is handing back project ones. I have some. I won't go through the names again. You can just pick them up at the end of this session. So as you see, most of you have done well, and I assume you probably have no basis of complaint. Project two is due today, so we'll see if you do equally well on that. Now, particularly if you've been having problems with the coding, I know some people here are experienced developers and others aren't. If you haven't already, you probably figured this out, it's a good idea to get a partner, particularly someone who has more experience coding, if that's an issue. And that may help things a lot. It's oftentimes helpful to have. In fact, they do sort of a mentor program here, do they, where a young person comes in and they're assigned sort of a more, well, you have to be more senior if you just came in, but kind of a mentor type person to show you the ropes and all that. And so if necessary, we'll do that sort of thing here or just get things going. So any remaining issues on project two? From the stuff I've been seeing on Piazza, it's mostly just odds and ends, just crazy things like error handling and occasionally some odd combination of something that drives JLEX crazy. So what I want to do for the rest of today is get you into Project 3, which you start now working on. In fact, some people have already sent me questions on that, which is good. It means you started. So what I'll be doing is talking a little bit more about the grammar, talking about the assignment, what you need to do, and then talking about the JavaCup tool. The JavaCup tool is analogous to JLEX, but it doesn't generate a scanner. It generates a parser. And in some sense, that's even more vital. I'll be showing a little bit about parsing. But scanning, you always had in the back of your head, golly, I don't really need this stupid tool. I could just read characters. You know, if it's an A, it's an identifier, a reserved word. If it's a comma, it's a comma. If it's a plus, it's an addition or increment, and on and on and on. And you probably could. I think a lot of scanners historically were hand-coded, and they worked fine. Parsing is a little bit more difficult because you have constructs that are complex in structure. I'll be talking about an if-then, and you also have an if-then-else. You have something that looks like an assignment, But an assignment can also be an initialized variable. So sometimes seeing a little bit of code doesn't tell you the whole story. You can imagine if you just put a little window in the middle of a program and said, what is this? In some cases, you could tell. In other cases, not so easily, because you need the whole context. And that's something that parsing does for you automatically. So now I'd be talking about grammars and parsing, and the thing to put in back of your mind is the parser makes its decisions automatically, which means it looks at an entire program, a stream of tokens now produced by your scanner, and says this and this and this and that must be something I recognize. Maybe an expression, maybe a declaration, maybe a particular kind of statement. It then allows you to automatically call a bit of code, which won't create a token, you've already done that, but create something even more important, namely an abstract syntax tree or a subtree to be wired in. So if it sees something that looks like an assignment, there's something called an assignment node, which routes all assignment statements. What you then do is fill in the subtrees, those are parts already been parsed, and return it back to whoever's going to use it in a larger context. That assignment might be part of an if or part of the body of a loop. That in turn is part of a method. A method is part of an entire class. So it's able to fit the pieces together bit by bit automatically. When you're programming all this, since I'm giving you the grammar with one little gotcha that I'll talk about, namely the if-then versus the if-then-else, you don't have to worry about creating the grammar. And as I said, in some cases, the grammar does a lot for you, a lot more than you might at first appreciate. So your main task is to say, here's a production. Whenever Mr. Parser finds it, here's the corresponding AST structure I want to build. In most cases, you'll create a new AST node and link some subtrees in. In very simple cases, you may simply say the AST created for the right-hand side of the production just gets carried forward. No changes are necessary. And I'll show you cases of that. One simple case is I put parens around an expression. What will happen is I'll have a production that says something or other goes to paren, expression, close paren. Well, the expression inside the parens has already been parsed, which means somebody else created the AST for it. Now, the parens were just in there for grouping. Doesn't change the meaning. That is, an expression by itself or an expression with parens around it has the same meaning. And in fact, the parens aren't even kept. Once they're used as delimiters, they're tossed because the info is already in the tree structure. So that means you simply say whatever was inside the parens is the result of the parenthesized expression. And that's usually wired in to a still bigger tree, maybe as part of a bigger expression or part of a conditional statement or part of an assignment. And it all kind of fits together nicely when you get the hang of it. So let's get into that. So when time ran out last time, we were talking about the one spot in the grammar I've given you in the assignment that has an ambiguity. Now, ambiguities are bad because they mean the meaning of a structure may not be uniquely determined. We have to make it unique, and there is a standard fix. What happens is, historically, when people first built these structures, they didn't realize the full implication of the ambiguity. Later on, they did, but it was already in the language, and people were used to it. So they put a fix on top of it. So it's something where two interpretations are possible, but one is the standard accepted interpretation. The other says, no, no, that's not really right, and you have to fix it. So two ways to fix it, as I'll show you. One is to change the grammar. It's doable. It's a little tricky because you have to change a couple of productions. Or to actually, at one stage when the parser is built, say, here's an ambiguity, but I'll sort of intervene and tell you this is the way to resolve it. So I'll say, yes, you could do this or that, but if you do it this way, it'll work out right. Please do it that way and ignore the other alternative. And I'll explain that. So let's make sure we're comfortable with what's going on. Get that out of the way. So remember, the problem is if I have a nested if that has fewer else's than ifs, there's a potential ambiguity as to which if the else belongs to. And that's important because remember, the if controls whether the else is reached or not. So here's a simple case where I have if A is equal to B, then if B is equal to C, A gets 1, else A gets 2. But the question is, which else does the if associate with? If we look at the grammar, it can actually be done both ways, and I'll show you that in just a moment. But it turns out there's a rule, and it's the rule you'll need to enforce, that says an else is always associated with the nearest unmatched if. So that being the case, if I go ahead and look at this, it says here's an else. There are two ifs, the nearer one and the farther one. And it says, therefore, this else associates with this if. So the over bar shows you how things are grouped. So it said, oh, and I didn't complete that, sorry. So it says, if A is equal to B, then do this entire remaining if-then-else statement. It says, then if C is equal, B is equal to C, A gets 1, else you do the else part and A gets 2. An alternative could have been to associate the else with the if. That would have been syntactically viable. The grammar does allow that, but it would have a different meaning, notice, because in one case, A not equal to B would immediately get you to the A gets 2 assignment. In this case, it has to be the case that A is equal to B, but B is not equal to C to get you to the else. And one thing I'll point you out is some people, when they first learn programming, are pretty naive. And it turns out that one of the dangers about this structure as it is that even if we resolve it, we can make things very misleading. And let me show you how. You all learned when you were doing programming that structuring programs is nice. In fact, in our parsing, we have an unparser that tries to be very nice in unparsing by doing line breaks at the right spot, indenting things at the right spot, etc., to give you a visual interpretation of what goes with what. But be careful, because those indentations normally are done, or are mostly done by hand, and they're not guaranteed to be the really syntactically meaningful. And let me show you what I mean on that. I could have written down if A is equal to B, and then write down the else, A gets 2. Yeah, I'm just, let me make sure I found my example, yeah. And then inside here, say, if B is equal to C, A gets 1. Now, there's sort of a double whammy here, because the situation is that this thing looks different than what it really means. And unless you have something smart, I'm not even sure if Eclipse is smart enough to do this. Normally, what would happen is if you have something that automatically pretty prints, as Eclipse routinely does, this is probably impossible to get unless you manually enter it. But the problem is, in this case, you could look at this thing a dozen times. I had somebody in yesterday that had a minor typo in his definition, and he and I were looking at it for probably a good 10 minutes, and neither of us saw it. I went off and talked to somebody else and finally noticed that there was a missing character and fixed it. But those sort of things where the thing looks right but isn't are some of the worst errors around. So you can imagine seeing this, and you go ahead and, in this particular case, even though it looks like the if and the else associate, the rule of language still says no way. This is simply a misleading way of writing down what I showed previously. It really ought to be the case that the else gets indented in to associate with the inner if, not the outer if. What makes this doubly bad is the way this could have been created is not by some fool not understanding the language, really, but by something where you had something totally different in here originally. So originally you started with a program like that, without this thing in here, and you say, oh my gosh, I need this extra test. So you said, I want to have this test inside the if, and you write it down, not even looking at the else. It's there in front of you. And I see people smiling because you've probably done it. I have too. I remember taking days. A program was misbehaving. It couldn't possibly be happening, but it was. And we said, well, there had to be something wrong, and we didn't have pretty printers at the time. And finally, you know, we went down to think, well, let's start matching these suckers up to see if that's the problem, and it was. So if it was the case that you originally had the if-else and put the inner if in later, you're focused on, okay, if this is true, I want to do that also. And you're not noticing there's that else there that this guy silently grabs. So it turns out that we live with this and we have a fix for it, but it's only a partial fix because it leads us, unless we have sophisticated tools like Eclipse that would perhaps force the formatting on us or give us a warning that at least there's a potential ambiguity, you can have something that looks right but means something different. And that's some of the worst bugs at all to find, because nothing glares out at you. You have to put on pretty printing or do tracing or debugging or whatever. So you say, well, that's a dumb thing to do. How should they have done it better? And the problem really is, notice we have something that begins an if, but we don't have an associated closure that says this is the extent of the if. It's almost like having an open brace, which doesn't always have a matching closed brace. So in some language designs have been suggested, it just simply hasn't caught on, that every if ought to have something that says, here's closing the extent of the if. So after the if then, or the if then else, you have to have a closer, something like end. You wouldn't really want to use end because end is used for other things like begin sometimes. So people got clever, and what they did is they said, we'll have the thing that closes an if is an if reversed. So an if reversed is an fi called phi or phi. And in some languages, you would have something like this. That for every if, you had to have a matching phi, which is the end closer for that. And that shows you the extent to which you wanted the if to go. So in this particular case, it would show I wanted this if to match up as it shows here, and this guy to be only in. So this would be a proper formatting if I had the phi's as shown. If it's a situation where I had something like this, phi phi, that's just something like if or end, then it's the case that I was situation there, the inner if and then the outer if matches. In this case, the else would associate with the inner if. So if I was willing to change the language and change programming styles, as it were, it's an easy enough fix. People stuck their heads out and they said we should do it, but it hasn't really caught on. So C, C++, Java, C Sharp, and I think lots of other languages have that sort of issue. So historically, it's kind of honest. We know how to fix it, kind of. But again, we'll accept the language as it is, imperfect as it is, but understand that in a better world, perhaps we ought to have something like this that totally eliminates the possibility of ambiguity. You put the phi's or whatever else you want in. Just as kind of a funny thing, they did this not only for ifs, but in those days they had a case statement. And guess what they had for a closer for a case statement? ESAC. And I think they even did it for procedure. And if you can spell procedure backwards and pronounce it, you know, ECAPERP or whatever it happens to be, you're good. So it's one of those things, a good idea, and maybe that's why it didn't catch on, is it looked a little too bizarre for people to accept it or something. But the notion is still there, and as part of language design, it's there. In fact, since we have many cachet users here, does cachet have the similar problem in its ifs, or has it somehow been fixed? It probably has many different problems, but we're talking about fixing one in particular. Yeah. That's right, and that's an alternative, and that's somebody who's learned from it. Visual Basic is one of those languages that it has lived longer than it really ought to, but it's a situation. It's not clear if that's now that's really kind of a compliment, something when you find a niche and you're so good at it that you can't be really pushed out by succeeding languages, that means you really had something. So everybody kind of looks down their nose at Visual Basic, including me. But it has survived way longer than people expect. In fact, I'm told that Microsoft is finally stopping support for Visual Basic. Is that correct? But I mean, but even some level of support? I mean, situation? No, okay. I don't know, because situation, remember, I was trying to write some macros for Excel, which is certainly still supported, and they wanted Visual Basic for their macro structure. And oh my gosh, it's hard when something's similar but not identical to all the stuff you know. So I had my fun with Visual Basic. But does that mean Excel's not going away anytime soon? So
they don't support Visual Basic.
So always some way to tap dance around the problem. Okay. So anyway, so getting back to the problem you have, what you will have to do at some point is change the grammar, and I'll give you some hints on that later, or direct the parser to make the correct choice. So what's going to happen, to be clear on this, is you're going to get a message if you have both of the if-then varieties in the grammar that you have a so-called shift-reduce error. Think of that as just gobbledygook saying that I can't make a decision on how to parse. And I'll explain in a succeeding lecture what shift reduce means. But what you can do is you can actually give a message. Oh, guy. You can give it a message that says, yeah, I know you have this problem of shift reduce, but in this particular case, do the shift. And it's going to turn out that the shift is, in fact, what you want done. And therefore, by just saying, in this particular case, I want you to ignore what appears to be an error message because I know better. I'm a human. You're only a mere computer. And you'll be able to get the thing to work. And I'll explain that. So for the time being, while you're working on the rest of the grammar, which is there, one thing you can do is disable one of the two productions. You're going to have to put it back eventually, but if you pull one or the other out, the ambiguity disappears and the parser will generate. So what you can do is either say all ifs will be if-thens, or all ifs will be if-then-elses. And if that says, ooh, that's pretty ugly, it's really not as bad as you say, because you can always think of an if-then as being something with an else empty part. And empty braces simply represent a block. Remember, a block's a statement, and a statement follows an else. And an empty set of braces says, I have no declarations and no statements. So it's kind of like saying the null body. So if you had a language that always required an else, you could go in and put that stuff in there. And notice, by the way, that would automatically fix this problem with the unmatched if-then-elses, wouldn't it? Because now every if would have an else, including possibly a null one. So whenever you saw this sort of usage, you say, oh, he just means an if-then. So I don't know any language that's had the guts to actually go ahead and do that. Maybe you do. But wouldn't that certainly be a terrible way of doing it? After a while, you'd kind of see this else nothing, and it would kind of tell you something. It's rather much like you've probably seen technical documentation where you have a page that says, this page intentionally blank. The first time I saw that, I said, what the heck, guys, that's crazy. I mean, why are you telling me the page is blank? Why don't you just leave it blank? But of course, you know why. Because by saying it's blank, it's not an error. It's not that a page failed to get copied or somebody forgot to enter something. That it just happened that at this stage you have enough and the page is empty. So this thing would say, this else intentionally blank. And that might be a solution. So that's a little just into the history of it, but you're going to want to do one or the other of that, because what I'll be getting in today is people already doing this, of what you need to do to start building your parser. The cool thing about this, as I'll show you, is that you can do this line by line, or in this case, production by production. So just as you did token by token, do one token, get it working, do another, you can do pretty much the same thing here. There's the case that the trees kind of connect. So you can't be totally random about it, but you can go ahead and add in pieces. So what we've done, and I'll show you later, is I've given you a working parser for CSX Lite. That's that language we saw, and it's actually documented in the back of the assignment. And that works. So it means that grammar will actually be acceptable to CUP. It'll go ahead. CUP has rules in there that build these AST nodes. And then we have something which looks a little weird, but something that you need, and we certainly need in terms of grading, is suppose you've gone ahead and done the parse and built a tree. The question is, what are you going to do to convince us and convince yourself that the tree is correct? It may well be the case that there's something missing in the tree. So what you're going to be asked to do is something called an unparser. I think that term was invented, now it's an unparser. I think that term was invented right around the time there was an advertising splurge where they were pushing 7-Up. And what was 7-Up? Anybody go back that far? It was the Uncola. So in this case, you know, this thing is the unparser. But it makes kind of sense. But really what this really is sort of a two-string. And I'm sure many of you have learned that two-string is really a very useful concept, because it makes potentially any object you define in Java visible by simply saying print it. And in this case, I could print an AST by doing a two-string, and it would print out essentially the structure, in this case looking like the original input. The trouble with this particular interpretation, and the trouble with two-string actually, is you can't have variants. You can't say give me a terse two-string or give me a verbose two-string. You can, of course, create new methods, but then they're not automatically called by the print routines when it needs a string. But essentially, unparser is a version of two-string that says, here's the tree, we'll walk it, and we'll produce something that looks like a pre-printed, that is nicely formatted, version of your input. So you simply said, well, here I started with the class, there it is. I started with the name, there it is. There's the left brace, and so on. And each of the symbols is there, suggesting as you walk the tree, you found all the data that was determined in the parse, and it is in fact in the tree because you're able to kind of reproduce it. So it's just like going backwards, and sometimes, you know, when you do a sanity check on various computations, you sort of invert the process. So if you're dividing something by something, you say, is that correct? Well, you just multiply and see if you get the original dividend. Yeah, dividend is the thing you divide, and then the divisor. So yeah, you just sort of undo the operation and see if it comes out with the correct value. And that's what you'll be doing there. So let's get back to this then. So you'll start with CSX Lite. What I suggest is add a few simple productions. You want to make sure that the parser is still happy. There's no generation errors, except for the if-then-else part. If you copy the grammars I've given you correctly, there should be no problem. You want to add Java code to build ASTs. If you, oh, did I lose something? Yeah. That's the problem. I'll get to that in just a moment because the situation, I suggest actually ones that are similar to things that are already in CSX Lite. So for example, if you already have something that does addition, put in subtraction, multiplication, division, and all the rest, because there. But just to answer your question so we don't get too far out of sync, the issue is to actually have these trees be reached, you have to have productions that build a structure above you. So actually what I'll recommend doing is going to add two stages. One of them is, if you start changing CSX Lite, at some stage you're going to have to make the major change. It's sort of like when a butterfly comes out of its cocoon. You know, it's one of these amazing things in nature where you have a caterpillar, and it does the change. And all of a sudden it's a butterfly, and it's hard to imagine two more different creatures, and yet they're kind of the same. So what's going to happen here is at some stage you're not doing CSX Lite, you're doing full CSX. So at some stage, you're going to have to say, I'm going to go from the baby stage, the cocoon stage, into the full butterfly stage. And the way it means is you'll have to change some productions up top. The big difference between CSX Lite and CSX are, one, CSX Lite is not inside of a class. That's not too bad because all you do is class and a name. That's pretty much minor change. But inside classes, as we know from Java, you don't have code by itself. They're always inside methods. So you have to have methods, which CSX Lite doesn't have. So at some stage, you have to have the infrastructure of saying, I'm going from the structure for class down to a method, and inside the method is where I'll find the declarations and the executable statements. You also find declarations at the field level, so you could trust those. So at some stage, you'll have to make the change. But yes, you're absolutely right. As you're doing additions, make sure there's a path down that says, very first thing that does prints out the root thing, the braces, and then it goes down to declarations if they're implemented. If it doesn't try to visit them. Goes down to statements if they're implemented, and then goes ahead and prints them. Yes. Exactly. In fact, I recommend is stick with CSS Lite for a while until you're comfortable with it, and it's time to make the change. And I'll show you the thing, because when you make the change, it's easy to for example, your test programs will have to change slightly because it won't be just empty braces anymore. It'll be class ID and braces. But once you're used to that, it's there. So add some Java code for some simple things. Add the unparsing code to display. And here's what I was just talking about. At some stage, you have to go from CSX Lite to full CSX. And then you add in all the rest of the stuff. There's some stuff like arrays that don't appear in CSX Lite at all that do appear in CSX. So you have to get to that. So any questions about the approach? And what I'll do is I'll take you later. We'll actually go through Eclipse and show you some of the stuff we're doing and some of what I'm actually talking about. And by the way, I did figure out how to get Eclipse to do bigger fonts. I knew there was a way to do it and fished around. The thing was, you had to set preferences not at the Eclipse level, but at the window level. And it kind of makes sense. Some windows can be at one font and one color. Other windows can be in other fonts and other colors. But you can make them big enough that projecting, or if you have poor vision, reading them is not as much of an issue. And I think I've got that one handled. So let's go and get back into... So what I'll be talking about first is Java Cup. Now think of Java Cup as being a cousin of JLEX. In fact, they were both created by the same team, a group of students and faculty under Andrew Appel at Princeton University. And actually, he has a book out on compiling, not as good as one that we know, of course, but a very good one nevertheless. And these are tools to support that. And he's been very generous in letting anybody and everybody use them for educational purposes. So Java Cup, and again, I think if you look at a cup, was back when Java always had to be coffee related. And I think it stands for collections of useful parsers or something. But you always had to come up with a sort of a fake acronym to, as a Java, you of course have to have a cup for your Java. So in this particular case, it's a tool that will take a specification in terms of not regular expressions anymore, but now in terms of production rules. But again, it'll have code associated with it, Java code. And just like regular expressions, it says, when you find this expression, I don't care, you figure out when you find it. But when you do, run this little bit of code. Now we're going to say, when you parse this production, that is, you find all the symbols in the right-hand side in the right context, and you can guarantee this is the correct program to use, a production to use. How do you know? Well, we're going to design it so it can't make mistakes. Not obvious how we do that, but we will. It says, when you do that, execute this code to build a little bit more of the AST. What will normally happen is all the symbols on the right-hand side have already been parsed. That means their little ASTs have been built. You say, what is this construct I'm currently doing? Wire the little subtrees into a bigger AST and return that back to whoever is going to use the result of this production. So as you can imagine, and we'll talk more about this, you kind of imagine it being built bottom up. It's sort of a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more. So if you've ever had one of these things where you have a kit to build something, back when I was a youngster, it used to be the case that you had plastic models for boats and planes and so on. Do kids still do that? I think they did. I mean, the situation, you know, when you come up with you'd build a little bit of the wing and the tail and then the fuselage, and pretty soon you had the whole plane. Because what they didn't know then, they do now, is that the airplane glue they had used to be something that if you were a nasty kid and sniffed it, I never did that because I never knew it was the case, but it turned out the glue they used had some kind of volatile chemical in there that when the kids sniffed it, either good things or bad things happened depending on whose point of view you had. I think that's all been pulled out. And does anybody know what was in that stuff? Any chemists here? It had this funny smell, and that should have been a warning. But anyway, you go ahead and do that. So we're doing a kind of a similar thing where we're going to build a tree, not all at once, but bit by bit by bit. And of course, design-wise, that's just the right way to do it, because now each rule has responsibility for a little bit of the tree. So if a particular part of the tree is messed up, you pretty much know this is the bit of code I have to fix. And it's not like, oh my gosh, I have 100 productions here. Which one is wrong? Most of them are right, and you're able to get past the ones that are working and focus in on the ones that are problematic. And that certainly is one of the keys to debugging. If you can figure out very closely what it is, that part that's not working right, you go ahead and focus your attention on that, get it fixed pretty easily. If you have a huge program that says, I have no idea why it's failing, hopefully that never happens here, but situation there that it's a terrible situation. So at any rate, what Java Cup does is it takes a specification, some file with a .cup suffix saying I'm in the cup format, and it produces a file parser.java. And since that's a Java class, it goes ahead and it contains a method, a parse, that returns a symbol. What's that symbol? It's exactly the thing you were playing around with in Project 2. As you remember, symbols are the sort of things that get manipulated by both the scanner and the parser. So it's associated with the grammar start symbol. When the parse is all done, you have essentially info that points you to an entire AST. That old file sim.java that we are playing with, where did it come from? I had some questions of when you first started out. No question? Meet me back? Oh, yeah, I should have said. That's a very technical term and situation there. At this stage, think of it as just a specification. Something, and you go in there and some things are hydrophonic. And if you know your science, hydrophonic means probably has something to do with water. But it's a technical term. And in this particular case, the one I'll tell you about now, that's easy. It says it reads tokens one by one and makes a parsing decision based on only the next token and what it's already read. LLR is one of these sort of situations there that it's got a technical meaning, which I'm not prepared to discuss yet. So just think of it as one of these gobbledygook names. Whenever you're learning science, particularly if you're taking anatomy, you have to have all these crazy names, right? In a situation there. You don't have a leg bone. What's the name of a leg bone? Femur, that's right. And the ulna's in your arm, is that right? And you have the mandible, that's your jaw, and on and on and on. I'm a doctor, but not that kind of doctor, so I never learned them all. So, but at this stage, that's what it is. It's just some technical name somebody made up there. It's an acronym, as you might imagine. People call it LALR. Practically speaking, it's the most powerful parsing technique in common use. Powerful means that it takes the largest set of grammars. There are simpler parsers that take fewer grammars. That is, there's something that one parsing technique might say, I can't handle that, but LALR can. And because it's still efficient in space and time, it's very popular. There's ways to go beyond it, but not very much. And so anyway, that's it. But I'm glad you noticed that. Is it something I should have mentioned? Yeah, that's right. LL1 is a simpler technique. What's going to actually happen is I'm going to talk about two techniques, one called LL, which is the simpler one, and LALR, which is more comprehensive, but a little more difficult to understand. So it's sort of like Pop Warner League and Major League or something, a situation, right? In some of the baseball leagues, you're not allowed to throw a curve, right? I know in some baseball leagues, kids aren't allowed to throw curves because it messes up their arms. You know, you have to twist your arm somehow, and you don't want kids getting, Tommy John surgery at age 12 or something. That seems a little bit sane. So it's the same sort of situation. It's not allowed to quite do everything that the big leaguers are allowed to do, but it still does the problem pretty well. And the cool thing about it is it's really very intuitive. It's something where when you get the idea, you say, my gosh, yeah, that's a cool idea. But sometimes you have to be a little more technically deep to get extra power. So that's that. So sim.java, remember, is that file that contains all the names of the tokens, i.e. terminals, and the codes. And that's used by both a scanner and parser. And that guarantees when you return a token whose code is 17, the parser says, okay, I know what that is. It's the same token that you thought you just scanned. So a begin is a begin, an if is an if, a comma is a comma. When you start getting those messed up, the parser goes south very quickly. You won't have to worry about syntax errors, except to the extent that if you have a syntax error, it's probably by accident. You're typing up a test program and you mistyped it. It'll throw an exception, and I'll give you a little bit of code that prints out a message saying syntax error at line so-and-so. It turns out that usually in syntax errors, there's not a heck of a lot you can do beyond printing out a message, because knowing what a person must have meant when the syntax goes bad is very problematic. And it's a situation. I one time came up with a technique that it was just the opposite. This thing could parse absolutely anything. You give it a program that's slightly messed up, it'll parse it. Give it something that's totally non-programmed. Give it, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, or something like that, which is not a program by most standards. And it would convert that into a program. And I was talking in front of an audience like this, and it turned out that there were some military guys in there. And there was a bird colonel in the U.S. Air Force that came after that. And he came up to me, and he kind of thought what I was talking about was sheer garbage. He didn't, a little too polite to say it. He said, if any of my programmers ever use that, I'd toss them out the door faster than you can imagine. Because I think at that time he was probably working on SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, which everybody said would never work. But of course, now it does work because we had a lot of smart computer people here figuring out how to make it work. But the last thing he wanted to worry was something about you decide to whether or not this is an incoming missile and should I shoot it down or not, is having some program that was misinterpreted by some hotshot program corrector. So it turns out there are techniques that correct programs. The trouble is what they correct it to and what you might have imagined can be vastly different. Oh, that's okay. And one last line and we'll go on this. So previously I had a notion of if I want to not use Eclipse to force testing, I want to do it at the command line level, can I do it? And the answer is yes, you can. So situation, Java Cup is just a Java program, just like any other. And if you take Java, you can execute it. And what happens is it expects the name of the file, the content of the file to be on standard input. So this is Unix type terminology that says you can redirect the contents of a file into standard input and have it be read that way. So just mark this down there if you mean to do something at the command line level. But we'll also have commands inside Eclipse that will do all this for us. So you won't have to worry about this detail unless you really want to. Let's see where we go. Yeah, okay, this is a good place to stop. So it's half hour or so at 6:45. Let's resume, and we'll get into some of the details of Java Cup. And if you came in late, I have, you came in on time, so you don't need that.